Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hey, welcome to the 306th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Don Rivas and Madison Witten. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today we have our old bud. When I say old, I just mean age-wise.
He means ancient. It's me.
Yeah. Carlin Hudson.
Carlin, some very tasteful plastic surgery over the years.
Honestly,
you feel ageless. It's well
Botox
done.
Botox has come a long way.
You know, I feel like maybe we talk about this too much, but we got some feedback that people like it when we talk to our friends on the podcast. None of them were available, but we got Carlin to pinch hit.
Here we go. The roast of Carlin Hudson.
For once you actually were like, gave me a couple days in advance and look, guess who's available? Because a bitch likes to plan. And I said, yes, I will be available in a few nights. Thank you for the heads up.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, Carlin rejects our requests like 2 out of 3 times.
All the time.
I'm very busy planning.
Yeah.
It's not on my schedule.
I will say about Patreon real quick. One of our patrons of the week is Madison Witten. She's a new patron, the $20 level. Thank you, Madison. And I'm assuming she's at that level because she wants to get one of our awesome Just Shoot It hats that Carlin has been seen in the wild wearing on set.
I posted it today. Mm-hmm. I posted a photo today of it.
That's right. That's right. Jack in the Box campaign. Well done.
Thank you.
Looks good.
Oh, that was the Jack in the Box campaign.
That was the Jack in the Box campaign. And I wore the Just Shoot It hat.
How did it go?
It was awesome. Genuinely a very fun shoot, actually, which is.
Yeah. And you got to work with King Batch. That's cool.
King Batch.
That's
cool. Very funny. Yeah, it was fun. It was a really silly, fun little shoot.
Very cool. Well, so what I was saying is that you wore the Just Shoot It hat there.
And hell Madison, yeah.
Madison Witten, who's our brand new patron at the hat level. I was like, that name sounds familiar. And I realized that Madison had actually been a patron before at the $10 level and got a hat. But probably wanted a second hat. So I'm assuming that Madison removed herself from the Patreon and then rejoined to get another hat, which I realized is the only way you can buy 2 hats.
Madison, if you're listening, let us know what's going on.
Just shoot us an email.
Other listeners, if you've been patronizing us for the $10 level for a while and you want another hat, like let us know. We could figure something out, I think.
Have you guys noticed that things are changing, that there's just way more work now than literally 2 weeks ago? Like that work flow seems to be, I know this is obvious, but also interesting, just directly related to like COVID fears.
Yeah.
I would say that that is definitely true. Do you think that some of it is coinciding with just like business cycles a little bit as well? Like, do you feel like, I feel like oftentimes, you know, things start getting ramped up, you know,
around stuff early around spring,
now, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But work is back for sure.
Like 2 weeks ago, I think I was submitted for maybe 0 jobs. And Last week, I think I was submitted for like 15 jobs. I mean, it's like night and day difference.
Yeah, I do think there's like a little bit of COVID fear starting to lift again. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
I have a feeling that, look, for sure there could be like some new mutation that kills like every other person.
It's got to be very serious for people.
I mean, because even like the most COVID people are now like,
totally.
Fuck it.
We're weary. Yeah. People are tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we just want to get out of our houses and shoot some things that we have a plan to shoot because we have storyboards.
Wow. Excellent segue.
Well done. Mm-hmm. Well done, Oren. So yes, as Oren's hinting, the main topic today is talking about storyboards. I think it's great timing for all of us because, like Oren said, work is back. We're in the swing of things.
So storyboards, we all know, are a tool that we can use in filmmaking. Some people live and die by them. Some people absolutely can't stand them. And I think a lot of people, probably the three of us included, think it depends on the project, whether you need storyboards or not. Yeah. I think kind of the common knowledge that maybe you'd read in a book about storyboarding is, oh, if there's an action sequence in this movie, we'll storyboard that action sequence and everything else we'll just, you know, figure out how to shoot, you know, off a shot list. But I think, you know, especially with the explosion of short form stuff, whether it's commercials or promos or episodic things, music videos, branded content, it's not unfeasible to storyboard an entire, you know, 5-minute short nowadays, where I think in TV, I don't know that you would storyboard like a half hour episode or an hour episode or an entire movie because it's just labor intensive. But so I'm curious with you guys, how do you decide whether you are going to storyboard on a project? And, you know, obviously use like kind of your most recent projects, maybe as examples.
The one I'm prepping now and the previous job I just did are very good examples of when I really like to storyboard versus when I don't. So the previous one, heavy, heavy improv. It was soft scripted. Oftentimes talent was operating the camera because they were meant to play like vlogger influencer types. And so when things are that loose, I find that unless I need very specific imagery, storyboarding is just kind of, it's like wishful thinking. Whereas the next one that I'm doing is very specific in terms of transitions and, you know, you basically the storyboard effectively becomes the script. You know, like the script says like, you know, the camera flies around the product or whatever, but like no one really knows what I'm talking about until they see the blueprint, which is effectively the storyboards and in this case, an animatic. What about you, Carlin? Where do you like to draw your line?
Drawing wise, I am shit. I once had storyboards that I drew myself, which I don't do anymore, but they were passed around as a humor piece to a crew. Joke. Yeah, because and I was like, yeah, pass them around. I'm like one of the least gifted visual artists. I'm truly terrible at drawing.
I want to pump the brakes there. Pause real quick. Listeners at home, even if people razz you, the importance of a storyboard is communicating.
Yes.
The ideas, the shot composition, all of that stuff. That can be stick figures. It does not have to be incredibly rendered. It's helpful because like people don't have to use their imagination quite so much. They're not filling in the gaps, but like don't be ashamed of rudimentary drawing, even if your crew razzes you.
In fact, if I can find them, I will send them to you guys and you can share them because they are funny. But even like the nose kind of triangle pointing a certain way, you know, this was like earlier on in my career or whatever. And so it is a helpful exercise to draw them yourself. I think maybe this is helpful to listeners, maybe not. But like now when we're talking about storyboards, I'm not personally drawing them. Like I hire someone to draw them.
That is worth clarifying and is maybe the real deciding factor. It's like, does it make sense budget wise for us to board for a few days or not?
Yep. Yeah. So it depends on the job. And also like I actually did just pay for storyboards myself on a project. It's a feature that I'm pitching on to direct, and I did like a really extensive lookbook, but I just kind of wanted to go above and beyond. And like, this is a comedy with a lot of big set pieces and like action kind of sequences. And so I did storyboard, like I paid out of pocket to work with a guy we both work with sometimes to storyboard a scene. And it was really fun and useful for me to imagine how I would cover that scene, even while I'm not even attached to this film. So, right. Well, I'm just like trying to get it.
It's interesting for our listeners, especially newer filmmakers that maybe are just starting to figure out what their career looks like. I'm sure a lot of people are curious if they've never hired a storyboard artist, how much does a good kind of Hollywood level storyboard artist cost? Do you guys, I mean, I have a number in my mind.
I was going to say 600 a day.
I think six is like maybe on the slightly low. Cheaper it's side. Like
yeah. Doing your indie film maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. like the friends and family rate.
I think commercials. Yeah. Like 750, 800 probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A day.
Yeah.
And the related question is, and I don't think there's a firm answer for this, but how many storyboards do you get for that much money? Like how many boards do you think your average good, fairly fast storyboard artist can draw? And obviously, you know, it can range all over the board if they're doing them in color, if they're shading, if they're just doing kind of outlines.
Well, those are big, important delineations, though, and oftentimes are baked into the pricing, right? Black and white is always going to be cheaper than full color. But sometimes you can be like, hey, I just want roughs. You know, I want your thumbnail sketches rather than something fully rendered. And that can maybe shave a day off as well.
Right. Well, so if I want
like 50 to 80
frames
that's
a day,
high. I would say that's high.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd say 15 to 25.
Well, I'm Mama Bear. I'm right. I think I got like on my last session. Well, no, because it was 2 days. It was 2 days. It was probably in like the 39 to 50 range is what
when I ask for like 20 frames from my guy, Andrew Paul, shout out to you if you heard. He's like, okay, 20, they're going to be rough and I'm going to be working fast. I mean, he's probably done 30 for me, but when he does 30, it's like a wide shot and a close up, you know, and that counts as two frames, but it's literally the same drawing. He just like zooms in on it.
Oh my God, I'm so out of touch. I'm just saying, I don't know, 100 a day?
Well, maybe your storyboard artists really like you.
Yeah.
They're doing like working all night long.
Part of the fun of working with a professional board artist is their rough, their thumbnail, their representational thing. A, still gets the point across, but B, is like so awesome compared to what you would do trying your hardest at home. Right.
It is 100% understandable, and you can show it to an agency person, you can show it to your crew, you can show it to whoever. Like in Carlin's case, I don't know if I've ever done it, but I've been thinking about it recently, is hiring the storyboard artist for the pitch. Actually, on this commercial job, I just didn't get, it's a 15-second commercial, and it's like five perfect shots, you know? And I was like, maybe I should just do the boards ahead of time, which now I guess I'm happy I didn't, because
it is a gamble. I think that back in the day, like, I think you could ask your production company to do that and maybe they would go for it, you know?
Yeah. You remember we had these directors, the Pierce brothers, that made this movie, The Wretched, and one of them, Drew Pierce, is actually, his name is Drew, so he's obligated to draw for a living, and he draws all his own storyboards. I mean, that's what he does professionally too, aside from being a filmmaker. And that was I was always so jealous of them because they would pitch their movies and they did these genre films. I mean, they still do. And they would have all these sequences storyboarded out. And so you go to a person, you're like, and then, you know, they're good writers and good visualists also. So it's really good. It's like kind of Hollywood level stuff that they get pretty much for free from doing the work themselves. And so that's how they've gotten pretty good at like pitching their ideas and raising money off of being able to draw.
Great boards. I think that also brings up the point that like most board artists are capital A artists in maybe a slightly different discipline, and that this is their money job, which is kind of part of why their rates are what they are. Like this, like no one's doing, I think most of them love storyboarding because it's still a pretty hard and highly skilled job, but like, that's part of what that's their survival job most typically. Like they oftentimes will come from fine art or from comics, a lot of comics people. And that's like a really competitive industry as well. So it makes sense that people kind of double dip a little bit
right
between the two.
Well, I want to talk about how we work with storyboard artists, because I think it's interesting to kind of hear how you all do it. But for those of our listeners that aren't working with storyboard artists or can't like afford to work with them, I want to, after this conversation, we'll transition into some ways you can storyboard things without a storyboard artist. I want to make sure it's helpful for everyone. But so on that note, Carlin, when you sit down with a storyboard artist, what materials do you already have ready to show them?
So normally I have kind of like what the location would look like if I haven't been there, then, you know, like for this thing we just did, it was like, oh, this is what the auditorium might look like. Like, this is the kind of location that I had in mind. Cause I do think location is obviously like, that's such a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. So I have pictures of the location, like some idea of the cast if they're not cast yet. And then I make a shot list, and then mm-hmm. we kind of go from there. But we'll get into this more in a second. But I've worked with like 4 or 5 different storyboard artists. And the guy that I worked with now a couple times, who was recommended to me by Matt Enlow, his name is Mike Jasorka. You call Shout him Mikey. Mikey.
Yeah.
I don't know him well enough to call him Mikey. I hope soon. But currently I call him Mike or Michael. But
yeah.
But he is one of like the more collaborative people I've ever worked with. So you kind of like sit with him while he's drawing the storyboards, mm-hmm. which is something I've never done prior to working with him.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back in the day, you would meet him at a coffee shop and he would like literally bring
sketch pads
and like wow. an easel. And it is a very different experience than a more old school experience than, you know, commonly now people are drawing on tablets and,
yep.
you know, it's kind of designed to be a little bit more streamlined in terms of it being digitized. Like he'll leave with like a stack of drawings and then have to go scan them. Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So like mm-hmm. the turnaround is a little bit different, things like that.
Yeah. But the way I work with my current guy is we're on Zoom. He actually now, you know, COVID times, he doesn't even live in LA anymore. He used to live in LA, but now we just go on Zoom and I see he shares his screen. He uses some program. It's kind of like a Photoshop type program, but it has the frames, you know, he has like 6 mm-hmm. 16x9 frames on the screen. And I describe the shot, I show him images and he starts drawing. And, you know, really that first session is about us getting the angles and the shot size and, mm-hmm. you know, like Carlin saying, the location and what cast is in each shot. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he'll go off on his own and make them look pretty. But, you know, I do wonder, like, I know there are some storyboard artists that just take a script and they board it. You know, things have been boarded before a director's even attached, which is crazy.
Yeah.
But to me, it's hard to imagine a storyboard artist boarding something without me telling him, like, no, just a little bit wider, a camera mm-hmm. a little bit lower.
Well, and so yeah. we were talking a little bit before about the difference between something that's fully rendered and a thumbnail. Part of what I like to do ideally is kind of have a little bit of time in between thumbs and things that are fully rendered, because that gives me the chance to play with the image a little bit more. Like if you have something that's rough, still malleable, you can say like that the board artist can show you specifically what they thought you told them to do, but it's not so far down the line that they've just spent, you know, 45 minutes putting the finishing touches on this image. You know what I mean? You can kind of see the in between. And sometimes that can happen in real time as you're looking over their shoulder, but sometimes between scheduling and life and all that, they, you know, need to just kind of send you stuff a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you guys ever find that it's hard to like come up with dynamic shots in the storyboarding process, because by definition, it's a still image that's representing your motion. And I'm always wanting to say to make one shot into 4 frames, like, okay, it starts mm-hmm. here and then it pans mm-hmm. here. But I want to see that she went from happy to sad. So I think we should draw her happy and then sad, you know, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden I've used up 4 frames for one shot, right. you know, so.
Well, so that's interesting to bring up, though, because I've started really leaning on animatics, especially for commercials, which is where you'll take the storyboards and then drop in a little bit of temp VO. It's nice that I have this nice microphone, thanks to podcasting, and maybe even a little bit of music or some sound effects if you need to. And I'll do all the voices and put that into Premiere and then time things out so that I know exactly what the runtime is and if jokes are working or not. It gives me a chance to kind of like really get a feel for the piece and come up with new ideas. It's become a big part of my process. Huh. But part of that is that now I will ask the board artist to either deliver me Photoshop files or just draw separate elements. Like if they know, for instance, that I'm going to have a shot of a phone and then I need the finger to swipe, they'll give me a finger and then the phone, and knowing that I will animate the swipe in the animatic.
Yeah. They give me the finger all the time.
but that's a different thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, and in the case of like you're doing it real time with them, they can ask you like, oh, do you want this element to move? Do we want to do this in sequences, or should I draw like a little, basically like a virtual prop over in the corner for you to animate later? And they're very rudimentary. It's just, it's like two or three keyframes always.
Yeah, I do that a lot. My favorite is like when someone gives me a storyboard and I know we're out of days with that artist, but I want to change something or the script changed. And so I bring it into Photoshop and I erase some part and like try to redraw it myself. And it just like looks so different from their storyboard. And I'm just like constantly waiting to see if like anyone says anything like, what? Like, yeah. Why does this person's face look like a 5-year-old drew it compared to all other faces?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I was going to say the other thing on animatics that I've started doing that I'd love your thoughts on. Basically, after they've drawn all of their frames, I've started, if I realize, oh, I want a new shot of, not like a close-up because you could just zoom in, but like if something totally new, I'll find images on the internet and kind of Frankenstein it together as a placeholder sometimes. Again, very rudimentary, but like as a way of illustrating how things flow together. And especially when things are very, very visual, I found that that's been super helpful, actually. And it's like a weird thing that I, even 2 years ago, would never think would be part of my process.
Like you're saying, this is unrelated to storyboards. You find images on the internet for your animatic?
I'm saying that if I have 2 days with the board artist, they'll send me their roughs. I'll put them into an animatic. I'll realize, oh, shoot, I want a shot of a person smiling, and I'll drop that in to the animatic, find some stock imagery, put that into the animatic, adjust it to the right size and angle and all of that stuff, and then send that animatic over to the board artist saying like, hey, I need a frame that looks like this, but with our actor instead of the person in this shot or something like that. And because it's in that animatic, they can kind of see it all. They get the sense of how it all flows together, right?
And an animatic is just it's like a rough animation of all the frames together.
Yeah.
In Premiere.
Effectively just sequencing all of those storyboards with voiceover underneath. And you can get more and more involved, you know, the further down the rabbit hole you fall. But you find camera moves, you find like ways to plus things, you figure out if it's funny or not. It's really, especially when you have like a specific runtime you're trying to hit, I find it to be invaluable.
I have a question, because on a couple recent jobs, I was so prepared for a couple jobs that the agency producer was like, you shouldn't have done this much, because then it gave like... the client was sort of like then too involved, because do you know what I mean? Has that 100%. Ever happened to y'all?
Yes. Yes. On a job relatively recently, I had the chance to prep it really early and like, with like some very specific renderings, and like, it's easy to be like, oh shoot, like we don't like that color, or like, is the wardrobe really going to look like that? And you're like, no, this is just a drawing.
Yeah. You know?
But it's easy for people to get hung up on things. And so you do the tricky thing with storyboards is that they do sometimes become prescriptive in a way that can be hindering for sure.
Yeah. Oren, has that happened to you?
No, I don't think anyone's ever told me I like did too much work.
Which of the three of us, I feel like you were like the craziest in prep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. I get frustrated when I feel like I showed them what the exact commercial is going to look like. And then we show up on set and I set up a shot and they're like, we don't like that. And I'm like, well, you approved the animatic, you approved the storyboards, you approved the script. Like, why now? I showed you every step of the way exactly what this is going to look like. Mm. So I've had, it's kind of like the opposite or an inverted version of that.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Oren, because to Carlin's point, you prep so hard that you will oftentimes
make an animatic that's better than the final product. Yes, I know.
but also when I say animatic and you say animatic, they're two pretty distinctly different things. Mine is like a bunch of storyboards cut together with some, you know, cut out animation on top to show people the timing. Yours is oftentimes a fully 3D rendered situation where you've got a virtual camera with the lens on that you are intending to use in the literal exact angle that you're intending to use. People are walking from place to, you're rendering it all in Blender. There's some pretty extreme, prep that happens in yours. You feel like if you know that you're going to go so far down the prep in terms of like literally building it out in 3D, and that's part of your process where you're finding the angles in that virtual environment, how does storyboards, how do they fit into that sort of prep, right?
Yeah, I've probably had like two or three jobs where I basically did that. I built the location in 3D, I put the actors in 3D, I put the cameras there, I lit it, and I made my own boards and sent them to the storyboard artists, and they just literally like outlined them and changed the actors to look more like the people we cast. But recently, if I'm going to do that, then I just take the money that's for the storyboard artist.
You just don't have a board artist. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm the board artist. And I've had a few jobs where because I've done this a lot, some repeat clients where they're like, do we need a board artist or can you just do your 3D renders? And the reason, like, so one of the reasons I like the 3D renders is because what I find with a lot of board artists, like Matt mentioned, is that they come from a fine arts background. They're drawers, you know, a lot of them do 3D and other things as well, but most of them come from like a drawing background, and they're not great always at understanding what lenses are, you know? Mm-hmm. Like when you say, oh, I want like a really long lens here so that this person feels close to this person, they'll be like, just tell me what part of the frame this person's head is and what part of the frame this person's head is. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll say like, yeah, but like, why are their heads the same size? Like this person should be, you know, we're on like a wider lens. And I find that like some of that film language, like the camera language they don't all connect with it. And it leads me to this pitfall a lot of times where the storyboard artist draws a frame that looks great, that tells the story I want to tell, but I get to set and it's not a shootable frame. Mm-hmm. Because they have no limitations of distances and angles and physics,
basically. Yeah.
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 Yeah. It's true.
When I'm in a situation where I'm worried about where to put the camera and if we can actually physically get this shot that I want to get, then I will usually just start mocking it up in Blender. And by some point I've just designed the entire set and done all the boards. And at that point we have to call my board person and say like, hey, actually we don't need you. Sorry.
Any listeners at home are like, oh, this is crazy.
This is crazy. I don't do any of the Blender stuff. I know I've heard you talk about this before, Oren, but I'm like, what? So everyone does have a really different process.
I do think my favorite process is probably also the most accessible process, and it is the photo board.
Walk us through, Oren, what is a photo board?
So it does require some things, and it does not, like if you're doing a science fiction movie or something, there's some certain things that are very difficult to do this with. Let's say you want to shoot a scene of a skydiver, and you only have access to the skydiving team on a certain day. You couldn't do this, but a standard scene where you have people in a location, if you can go to that location and bring some people. It does not matter who they are. Then you just have them stand in the location and you literally just block out the scenes. And, you know, you try to cast it a little bit. Like, hopefully if you have two friends with you, they can each stand in for a different actor. And, you know, they kind of spread their legs based on how tall they're supposed to be, because the actor's height makes a big difference, you know, with the camera angles. And what I love about making photo boards is, of course, I'm not just shooting the boards I need. I shoot like 50 different versions of each angle. You know, I have my iPhone. I use either Artemis, where I can actually choose the lenses that we'll have. I know we're going to get the Master Primes or whatever, or a zoom lens. And so I know what lenses we are going to be shooting with. Or I just use the camera app and I just take a bunch of photos and I take videos and I run around. And, you know, actually Mercedes Bryce Morgan, who was on our podcast, is one of the inspirations for this. She told us that she figures out all her action scenes with her iPhone and, you know, just goes and blocks them all out. And I was like, why am I not doing that? Like on every single thing. And it doesn't have to be an action scene. It can be a talking scene. It can be anything. But if you are in a location with your phone or, you know, any camera, I recommend your phone just so that you can always have it in your pocket and you can show it to people at all times. Like if you shoot on your phone, you can just explore and you can find things. And that is actually one of the other pitfalls of storyboards that I find is you're really locking yourself into a plan that you're sharing with your cinematographer, with your production designer, your producer, with your AD. And it's hard to stray from that. But if you go to the location and do photo boards, with, you know, just film, like shoot the boards yourself, then you can really explore and you can find angles. And that's my fear with storyboards always, is that I'm just like shooting the most obvious, boring version of something because I'm trying to pick 8 frames that represent this. When on set or at the location, I'll just find a bunch of unique camera angles, camera moves, like, ooh, there's an interesting railing or there's an interesting light. If we move the camera here, it'll be in the background. Yeah, so that's why I love photo boarding. And it combines scouting, blocking, planning things out, and making storyboards all at the same time. And if for some reason you need really nice storyboards for a pitch or for a, you know, real job, you take your photo boards and you put them in, I use Pages, and I just put them in storyboard format and I send them to the storyboard artist and they just redraw them. And I actually have a post on my Instagram of a Kentucky Lottery shoot I did where I have the storyboards side by side with what I actually shot. And product. They're so similar. You can't tell like if he drew the boards first and I shot it or if I shot it and he just copied them because they look exactly the same. And it's because he based his drawings off my photo boards.
Did you shoot those at the Tech Scout?
I shot them at the Scout Scout. So
it
is time consuming because sometimes I'll go, that was at a convenience store. So we went to like, you know, maybe 4 convenience stores or something. And I take all those photos at every convenience store.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'm also like learning about the scene and like the storytelling and stuff in that process.
And that's, I think, maybe the important point with all of this is that like the discovery happening earlier, I think, is really invaluable and has become a bigger part of just making things good. I just recently saw a coworker of mine started putting animated GIFs of the photo boards into the PPM deck. Have you guys seen that?
No.
It blew my mind. It's so good. So good.
So they're doing, they take like videos on
the... You take a video, specifically if it's like a walk and talk or if the move is important in some way, you know. Just putting it in GIF form just kind of shows you, that's a little bit more evocative than, for instance, you know, if it was strictly a storyboard, you'd just see some arrows. You know, and you people would kind of fill in the blanks. If there's two things to take away from this conversation, it's like exploration early on when the stakes are lower is really valuable. And then communicating to your crew, to everyone, any stakeholder, helps them do their job a little bit better, right? And especially when things are abstract or unclear in some way, you can make people's lives a lot easier. And the final thing I'll say about it is that it oftentimes saves the production a lot of money.
Can I tell you guys one more pitfall of storyboards, though? Just because I love complaining.
Orin hates storyboards. We get it.
No, I actually love storyboards, and I especially love like the animatic version that Matt's talking about. But just because something feels like it edits well in storyboard format does not at all mean that it edits well, like if you shoot it and cut the shots together.
Well, that's why I think an animatic is a little bit more helpful, because you can feel the amount of time that you imagine it's going to take a little bit more. Like, I'll add a little bit of movement or something, because I think maybe what you're saying, Oren, is that like one frame of a storyboard doesn't represent the amount of total time an action needs to take place, right? Like, if you see somebody punch or run or something like that, that could be 3 seconds, and that might be too much time in the spot that you're trying to cut, right?
Yeah, but even like in a storyboard, you might have a close-up on two people are talking. You have a close-up on the first person, then you cut to a two-shot of both of them, and then you cut back to the close-up of the first person again to say like another line. Like in storyboard format, that totally works, but sometimes if you're editing it like that, it's like a not a good cut. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like going, just ping-ponging back and forth between two shots can be like not like jarring filmmaking. And because especially when there's movement and you're not capturing that movement in storyboards, like what I find with animatics, especially if there's any visual effects, is that I've never given them enough time to mm-hmm. land in the animatic, because it's a still frame. So I'm like, I don't want to sit on a still frame for 4 seconds. That's so boring. But when you have something happening in that shot, 4 seconds might not even be enough to process. Maybe there's text on the screen, or maybe something mm-hmm. is like a flower is growing in front of our eyes. And in a storyboard, you'll just have like 2 frames for that. But on screen time, you'd need 5 seconds for that, let's say.
I have a dumb question. Could you make animatics even in like iMovie in something really simple? Because it's pretty 100%,
simple. 100% you could. Yeah.
Could you also use TikTok. Sold. Big TikToker. Could you use photo boards in animatics? Have you ever done that? Like the photos you take, the scout photos?
100%.
You've done that too? I've never done this. Interesting. Yeah.
But if you're going to do that, you might as well do videos. But if you go to directedbyoren.com, if you go down to St. Augustine, it's like a guy hitting a golf ball, there's a link that says animatic that you can click on. And if you click on that, you can see our DP basically acting out the entire commercial in motion. And that one, you know, we had some specific transitions we wanted, so we wanted to see them in motion. All this begs the question, at some point, we're just shooting the commercial by ourselves on our phone.
But I think also things get better and better as it happens. I don't think there's anything wrong with basically having shot the commercial, because inevitably you'll find the small little mistakes or just opportunities to plus it, you know?
Yeah. And just ways to move the camera. What's amazing about the phone is like, you know, sometimes you can move it in a way that you can't even move a camera. You can get such great ideas for camera moves.
And I think my final thing, and this maybe circles back to Carlin, your story about people teasing you about your rudimentary drawings. You don't have to show this work to anybody.
That's true.
You know, I think it's valuable for just to have for yourself, and just to have worked through things and forced yourself to really think through all of those different beats and ideas and stuff. You know, it's nice, your production designer, your DP in particular, those people are really going to appreciate seeing that stuff. Carlin, it was like, oh, you do so much work, and then all of a sudden you're just kind of locked into that prep. You know, just keep it to yourself sometimes, you know? That's not always feasible.
Yeah, I think it's also just having the confidence to get on set and to trust. If you have an instinct that actually a different way might be better, then not to trust that. Because sometimes mm-hmm. I've made the mistake before of, well, we planned it this way, and like the DP is telling me it looks better this way, and I don't know. And then I'll second guess myself, and then mm-hmm. in retrospect, I'm like, fuck, I knew it. I had an instinct to change it, but I didn't, because we had made a plan.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's just directing in general. It's not storyboard related per se, but that's part of the.
Yeah.
How frequently do you feel like, oh, I'm so glad I stuck to that plan?
Always. Oh, never. Wait.
Never.
Oh,
yeah. Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah. Yeah. Your gut is always right, basically.
Yeah.
But I guess this is three directors who were like, yes, if we'd listened to my instincts, things would be better.
Yeah, but you know, most
it's true.
Most great directors are opportunistic, I think.
Yeah.
You think hear the stories about, you know, Roman Polanski shooting Rosemary's Baby, and how he just has the actors walk to, you know, figure out their own blocking in the morning, and then they set up, figure out the shots and how to shoot it in the afternoon. Or you hear about Tim Burton just walking into a room, finding the one perfect angle to tell the story from, and only knowing that angle, and then everything else is just coverage built around that angle. You know, or even like I heard the story about Michael Bay, where his crew set up, like, you know, I'm sure I'm exaggerating, but spent 10 hours setting up this shot on an aircraft carrier, and they're about to shoot it. And he realizes that, like, if they shot in the exact opposite direction because of where the sun is, it would just look so awesome. And he's just like, tear it down. They're like, yeah, but Michael, this is the shot. This is the plan. He's like, I don't care. Tear it down. You know, turn the camera around. And, you know, I mean, obviously, there's people, he has fans, and he has people that don't really like him or his movies, but he's a famous filmmaker that has been very successful, and his visuals are undeniably epic, you know, and it's because it is opportunistic, you know, when he mm-hmm. sees like an incredible shot, he'll get it.
Put the Ferrari over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
put the explosion behind it.
Some of my friends worked on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm. that Tarantino joint. And they said that, I guess it's true, but they were like, yeah, every day he would have, just in case he wanted it, like a crane, a mm-hmm. process trailer, just all of the toys, just every day. They were there, just in case.
Just in he case, wanted just to hanging use them. Out.
Yeah, but honestly, for a feature, because we do so much short form stuff, it's like, oh, Technogrants, like $2,500, whatever. But on a feature, you're amortizing all these costs. You're shooting mm-hmm. for 3 months. Ends up making more sense to carry the Steadicam and the dolly and the Techno Crane and all those things, I think, right?
Let me see the budget for that. It makes sense to keep the process trailer for 4 months.
I think, look, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is an easy example. You know, whose time is the most valuable is the question in that feature. And you've got Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, maybe the two biggest stars in the world. True. And so, like, you can't schedule around like, well, Brad, you know, you're going to wrap a little bit early because the process trailer is coming tomorrow or whatever, you know. So in
my
that
point
case, I think
was
it makes sense.
He like, I think he just kind of just makes decisions when he feels it's more of like a loosey-goosey which none right. of us.
But know. Some of the best indie, I bet when you shot your indie films and stuff, some of the best moments are the ones where you're like, oh, wait, I know this was the plan, but let's do this instead. And that's what I love, at least about small productions, is mm-hmm. you get to make those changes. And when you're on a medium sized production, like most of the things we're on, when you have like 50 people or whatever, 100 people, and you change the order of things you want to shoot, now it just like screwed up lunch, it screwed up trailers, you have to move this thing. Like,
yeah,
I think it's also, we're time. Also talking about in the commercial world, we're beholden to so many stakeholders, right?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Can you just give me an example of a shot list? How you label a shot list? Like what's the wording that you write? Do you write like, and do you do 101A? Do you write one? Do you write eight? Like how do you label your shot list? How do you label your shots, and give me a sample description of a wide shot, a dolly shot, and a close up shot?
Say I'm making a shot list mainly for me and to talk to the storyboard artist. I would just do like whatever, like interior bedroom scene, whatever. And then just really simply write out like wide shot, dolly in as Kathy moves from A to B, you know, and just describe the shot.
And you wouldn't number it or anything?
Until I do shooting boards, that's when I number them. And that's when I put it all into an Excel document, and I'll put like which camera, which lens, mm-hmm. which whatever. Like that's much more thorough. But when I'm just making like my first shot list, it's just sort of like, what's the coverage that I see the first time I'm really thinking it through?
But do you put like a dash or like a bullet list? Like how you
dashes.
Don't even put any
numbers? I do dashes. No numbers. Just and dashes.
Do you guys, I don't know why I do this. I think I read it in a book like 15 years ago, but I write like the shot descriptions in all caps, like wide, like capital WIDE on and or CU. Do you guys write CU or close up?
I will write CU. I'm pretty loosey goosey. I will try to group things by setup, and sometimes I'll say like A cam and B cam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get much more prescriptive than that.
But you would write like over on Carlin.
Sorry. Yeah, more prescriptive than Carlin. Yeah, I would say medium over on Carlin, dirty over on Carlin, ACAM, you know, BCAM reverse on Oren.
And do you find if you give that to your AD or cinematographer, they'll understand what you mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Or they're mostly just counting how many shots you have, right?
That's I think they're mostly just counting. And I always put like bonus shots at the end of the list, you know, like what I would like to get, which I know is has a 75% chance of getting cut.
Or I'll put it in the shooting order sometimes as well. Like I'll be like, okay, like if we're going ahead, this bonus shot makes sense in this placement, basically.
Right. But when you're making the storyboard, like the first time you're sitting in Word or on a paper or in your notes app or whatever, you're writing it in order of the screenplay, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll oftentimes write it into the screenplay. I'll kind of break it out, basically. You know what you're making me realize, though, is that like years ago now, Tim Nakashi said on the show that sometimes he feels like he's the only person who knows what he's shooting at the time. And that sentiment has haunted me for years. And storyboards and animatics are just the best tool I have at my disposal to get what we're trying to get out of our brains into something a little bit more tangible so that people see what we're aiming for and can say that they approve of it and like it before we're on set, ideally.
So my last question is, have you guys ever used any storyboarding software or tested out storyboarding software? Found any other solution like that?
I'm very curious.
Me
to
too.
Use it. Yeah.
But I haven't.
There's a few kind of famous ones. There's this program called FrameForge that has been around for 100 years. Yeah, it lets you basically load up 3D models and rooms, and you can design, put walls and things like that. The other one that a lot of people use is Shot Designer Pro. And then that's not actually storyboarding, but you're really drawing overheads and blocking. And a lot of TV directors use that one. And somebody introduced me to a new one yesterday called Backlot. It's one word, backlot.app is their website. And it's like another one of these kind of 3D, build your locations, move your camera through the world apps. But this person that told me about it said it's relatively intuitive compared to all these very hard to use programs. There's one other one that actually plugs into Cinema 4D. It's like a package where you have cameras, you have lights, you have locations, you have actors. And it's basically this toolkit they give you to build scenes. The funny thing about all these programs is you as a director, you're trying to shoot things that haven't been shot before in ways that they haven't been shot before with people that haven't shot those things before. And so to think that someone will give you like a toolkit that has all the things you need in it to make your shots is just a counterintuitive idea because we're all trying to shoot new things.
Counterpoint, and I agree with you mostly, but like it's not like most of the things we're shooting don't have reference points. It's not like, you know, you're always going to be in a room or in the forest or on the beach. So it is conceivable that, say, environments, for instance, are all a collection of assets or something, for instance, right?
Right. But the coffee shop that you want to shoot in, because it has this unique feature, is going to be very different than some other coffee shop. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that maybe we're talking about like the more photoreal your boards are, the more reasonable it is for someone to be like, well, I think that this is literally what we're shooting. And so maybe we're stumbling into something about like something representational that's drawn maybe gives you a little bit more latitude to actually find the location of your dreams or the actor of your dreams or the camera move of your dreams.
Or the coffee of your dreams. Any final words?
Just remembering that the storyboard artists are artists and that they can be your earliest collaborator, I think is something that really opened my eyes up. And like coming in prepared and ready with great ideas, but then giving them the permission and understanding and incentive to talk through things with you, to pitch ideas, to ask questions, all of that stuff, and following those points of inspiration, that can be the first opportunity for you to explore, basically. And that they are a person who typically they'll have awesome ideas and different reference points. And, you know, that can be really cool.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks for chatting storyboards with us, Carlin.
Do you have a minute to hang out and endorse with us?
We can't pay you.
Okay.
For it.
Unpaid endorsements.
So I have two quick endorsements. One is for Purple Carrot, which is one of those like Blue Apron or any of those kind of like food subscription services. I've been pretty busy lately. I've been really pleasantly surprised basically every time with their meals. They're all vegan. It's very hippy dippy, but it's been really awesome for us, actually. I will say that it's not especially that much easier than just ordering ingredients and doing it yourself. There's still all the prep work and stuff, like measuring's not that big of a deal. But if you're the type of person who doesn't have a ton of bandwidth to like research fun new recipes and that sort of stuff, I think it could be a big unlock for people. I think we really enjoyed it, but also like we have like a lot of different recipes and different sources for new ideas and stuff. And it's still been really nice. But all of their meals are pretty great, actually. And like gave us just a baby step outside of our comfort zone in terms of the stuff that we had been cooking. Purple Carrot in particular has been pretty darn good and fun for us.
And what's the difference between the other services and Purple Carrot?
I would say that Purple Carrot leans, first of all, it's vegan.
None of the others are vegan, to my knowledge. Like HelloFresh and...
They'll have
blah, blah.
Vegetarian or vegan options sometimes, but it's like there's only so many times you can eat potato tacos or whatever. That's the complaint I've heard of, like,
yes,
if you're picky or something like that. You know, it's pretty spice forward, you know, like it's relatively international. There's like a lot of different styles of cooking that we have been trying. It doesn't feel as homogenous as maybe some of the other services have been. So pretty nice, pretty good. And then the other endorsement I have is a review of The Tragedy of Macbeth. Joel Cohen's The Tragedy of Macbeth, as reviewed by Ethan Cohen, his brother.
Oh.
And it is such a treat. I'll give you a few excerpts. The title is Joel Cohen's The Tragedy of Macbeth, reviewed by Ethan Cohen. More like McBlack.
It's a jokey review.
In The Tragedy of Macbeth, longtime Hollywood presence Joel Cohen, who has 18 prior films to his credit, takes sole creative control of a project for the first time. The result, not unlike the tale of Macbeth itself, is a tragic of epic proportions.
Did y'all see the movie?
No, but no. If it's dumb as a dog dick, as his brother describes it, then
hilarious.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Help, the no talent police are right around the corner. Please, someone rescue me before I'm exposed to a fraud who somehow fell ass first into a movie career.
Oh my God.
It's great. Anyway,
it was great.
Carlin, how did you feel about Macbeth? The Scottish
play. I liked it, but the cinematography is stunning. Like, it is a visual feast. It is beautiful. It is just such a gorgeously, creatively shot. To black and white, you know, it's visually, it's quite a masterpiece. And I liked it. I like Macbeth. I mean, it's Shakespeare, you know, you gotta
would you say
you
that
be down
it's rendered the bard's tale in black and white using a 4:3 aspect ratio, as if that alone makes you Akira fucking Kurosawa?
Yes, that's actually perfect. I actually did have to check my aspect ratio because I didn't know it was shot in 4:3, and I've had trouble with aspect ratios on my fucking DVD player, and I was like, God damn it, you know. But I was like, oh, this is purposeful.
There you go. Well, that reminds me, actually, speaking of Macbeth and Kurosawa, Throne of Blood is like a samurai retelling of Macbeth, and is by Kurosawa, and it's fucking awesome.
Hey, look at that.
So there you go, little bonus there.
Little bonus. Wow.
What a good double header that would be that I won't do.
You've got all the time. You're making your purple carrot meals. You've freed up an hour.
Yeah, there you go. Carlin, what you got?
Well, I have a book and an article because I'm a nerd. But the book that I just finished is called Detransition Baby. It was like a New York Times bestseller list, but it's a trans author, and it's about. You heard of this?
No, I'm just shaking my head because I'm in Babyland so hard that I was like, oh, is this a parenting book I should
be
aware
of?
Oh, really? Oh, good. Oh, awesome.
So it's like a trans woman used to be in a relationship with another trans woman. So they were lesbians. And then her ex detransitions back to be a man. It gets another woman pregnant, like a cis hetero woman pregnant. And then they all kind of like decide if they want to raise a child together. But it is. So it's such like a juicy, almost like beach read, but super queer and just like fascinating gender and sex, and it's just really fucking cool. It's like it's an extremely entertaining, like saucy, rich book with these amazing characters, but with the premise that you're like, holy shit. It's just wild, you know?
Yeah, I love that.
It's really good, and it's really thought provoking, but fun. It's like it's a thought provoking book, but it's a juicy, fast read. I loved it. And then there's a new New Yorker article about a profile on Celine Sciamma. I think that's how you say her name. She directed Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It talks about her process and how she's trying to kind of reinvent cinema altogether. Like she's pretty radical in how she creates stories from her own personal gaze and trying to how story structure is patriarchal. Boy, I sound like a raging feminist in these these recommendations.
No, that sounds great.
And she even talks about some of her past films. Like she has this movie called Girlhood that was about a young queer black woman in France, and she pretty readily admits how problematic and stereotypical it is. You know, she's just a really interesting artist and person, and just such a great profile, and really makes you think, maybe I'm thinking too limited about telling stories.
Yeah. Maybe there is more to life than maybe there's teen more comedies life. And
I mean, not in my life,
YouTube,
but speakers. Other people's life. Yeah, exactly. All right, awesome. What app you got for us, Oren? Let's hit me.
It's literally a keyboard shortcut.
See?
It's even more specific than an app. But I've been having this problem in Photoshop, and I actually believe this shortcut works in a lot of kind of image layout programs, but where I will copy something from one image and I want to paste it into another image, and it will paste it in the center of the image instead of in the same place it was in the image I copied it from. Mm-hmm. So let's say I have a logo and I want to paste it on 5 different images or something at the bottom right. I'll paste it into a new Photoshop image and it'll end up in the middle. And I've been so frustrated by that. And it turns out there is a shortcut on Apple. It's Command-Shift-V. I'm assuming on a PC, it's on Windows, it's Control-Shift-V. But instead of Control-V, it's Control-Shift-V, it will paste whatever you copy into the same place it was where you copied it from. And this is super helpful. Like when I make treatments, I have issues with page numbers. I want them to all be in the same place on each page, and they're pasting all over the place. So anyway, throw a shift into your shortcut. Maybe it'll fix the problem you've always had.
Have you done that between two different canvas sizes? Like if it's you've got a 16 by 9 image and you're trying to copy that. Copy from 16 by 9, but into 9 by 16. Does it just kind of approximate it, or?
I haven't done that yet, but I'm assuming it would probably do something different than just a regular paste. Mm-hmm. Where I run into problems is I use a lot of images with transparency. Let's say you have a logo and a picture, and the background is transparent, like in a PNG or something. If in Photoshop you select the whole canvas and hit copy, it's actually only copying the pixels that aren't transparent. So when you paste it somewhere else, though your document is, 1920 by 1080, what you copied is only 640 by 360 or something, right? So when you paste it, what's on your clipboard is smaller than where you copied from. So when you paste it somewhere else, it doesn't end up in the same place, even if those two documents are the exact same size. So that's kind of the issue I've been having, is copying semi-transparent pieces or parts of an image. Anyway, it's in case one of our listeners has this issue. Sure. That's the solution.
Oren, what I love about this endorsement is that Carlin dunked on you, and you just went straight forward anyway. You were like, let's go even nerdier.
I feel like she gave an example of what I would recommend, and I just 10x'd specificity of it.
Yeah, yeah. You're the most Oren of them all. Right.
Yeah. Oren Carlin's version of Oren.
Yeah.
I know. I almost out Carlin's version of myself tonight. So honestly, we're all an even
I think you're less Carlin than you think you are.
Okay, good.
Carlin, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you guys learned. If you have any questions or want to know more about our storyboard process, then go to my website, directedbyoren.com. Or you can email us, justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find me. I'm on Instagram at @okaplan. I'm on Twitter at @smightypyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. You can follow us at Just Shoot a Pod across all social media as well. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And Carlin, social media, hey Carlin, is that right?
Well, Twitter is Hey Carlin, mm-hmm. and Instagram is Carlin Hudson.
Mm, there you go. Very professional.
I know.
Carlin with a Y.
Yeah, Carlin with a Y.
That's it. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.